Lecture 21, The World of Witches.
Welcome to Lecture 21. In Lecture 20, we look at misogyny in the Western tradition as one of the causes for the witch craze. And then I also spoke very briefly about the Malleus Maleficarum. In Lecture 21 is the lecture you all have been waiting for, which is how to become a witch. That is to say, the kind of things you have to do to become a witch. So please take careful notes, because this is your opportunity now to be able to become a witch and to do all kinds of misdeeds to those people you do not like. I want to, before I begin this lecture, to show you in very vivid ways how this attack against women worked. In a village in Trier in Germany in 1585, two villages were in fact subjected to accusations of witchcraft, and only one woman was left in each of the villages, which shows you the kinds of attacks against women that were perpetrated in this period. The point, of course, is that by the beginning of the 16th century, armed with the Malleus Maleficarum, both Protestants and Catholics went into rural Europe and into the cities as well, and I will show you one example of urban witchcraft in another lecture. They went into the countryside and into the cities and began to identify and to bring to trial those who were accused of cavorting with the devil. This, of course, led to a tremendous amount of literature on witches following the Malleus. The Malleus was the example, the Malleus was the model, and then you have this extraordinary proliferation of books written, some by very learned and important men, some others by lesser figures. There are hundreds and hundreds, thousands of books written in the 16th and 17th century which describe for those who are interested in these matters how you can identify a witch, or the acts and deeds, the terrible deeds of witches. One of these books is a book entitled The Compendium Maleficarum, written by Francesco Maria Guasso in the 16th century. It is a hostile source and describes in luxury of details how you become a witch. And what I want to do in this lecture is essentially go through that book and essentially show you how you become a witch, the kind of stages you have to go through before you become a full-fledged card-carrying member of the great community of witches. The first thing, of course, in order to become a witch, is that you have to sign a pact with the devil. The pact, of course, plays an extraordinary role in the Western imagination. The pact is an agreement, a written agreement, which tells us something about the literacy of the early modern period, usually written in your own blood, in which you agree with the devil to give your soul to the devil, to do evil for the devil, to worship him as God, in return for which the devil will give you, Satan will give you certain things. What kind of things are you essentially entering into an agreement for? Wealth, sex, power, and the sweetest of all things, revenge. So in a sense, you enter into a pact with the devil or with Satan, in which Satan offers you something. And of course, the great idea of this, or the great example of this, is Dr. Faustus by Marlowe, Christopher Marlowe, also a book about the representations of witchcraft, in which Dr. Faustus gives his soul to the devil in return for knowledge, and eventually for a vision of Helen of Troy. So in a sense, you could see the kind of things you give up. You give yourself up to the devil in return for something. Who will not sell his soul, for example, for the Wizards to win in Washington one championship of the NBA, or for something like that? And how many times we in our modern society don't say things like, I will give my soul to the devil if I will get this or that. So it's part of a common expression. This pact is written in blood and is usually placed in a crossroads. The crossroads are places in late medieval and early modern Europe which were thought to be frequented by devils, which is why in crossroads to this very day, certainly in areas that have survived, you see crosses, the crusaders in Galicia, the crosses in the crossroads, which are placed there to, in a sense, scare the devils away from the crossroads. The pact can be entered for a number of years, 24 years, 41 years, or for a lifetime. And they are, of course, all written, in, as I said to you, in blood. May I point out to you that blood has a very particular meaning in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period. It is, in fact, the expression of the most deep commitment. But remember that many of those of you who are seeing or listening to this, that when you were a child and you exchange your blood, something that we will not do anymore in the world of AIDS, that you exchange your blood with a friend or a beloved, to mix your blood, to in a sense indicate that kind of commitment. I have an example here. In 1671, very late, at the very end of the wish craze, Joseph Egmont Schultz of Augsburg in Germany confessed that on 15 May 1671, towards midnight, he placed an illuminated pact. This was a very elaborate pact. It has been even with illuminated letters, written with his own blood where three roads cross. In Spain, one of the very few cases of witchcraft, a very notorious one, is the case of Magdalena de la Cruz, a Franciscan nun in the convent of Santa Isabel at Cordoba. In fact, she was such a pious nun that she was elected abbess of the monastery in 1533. 1536 and 1539. In 1544, she was accused of witchcraft, brought in front of the Inquisition, and voluntarily confessed that she had entered in with a pact with the demon named Balbar for 41 years. She confessed to this, the Inquisition didn't think much of this, and put her in a monastery for the rest of her life in a kind of imprisonment. So now you have signed the pact, now you have entered into a pact with the devil. What is the next step? The next step is the mark. The devil will imprint his mark on you. This is an important moment. The mark of the devil will be branded. You are branded by this mark of the devil. It is usually a small mark in the form of a bat or a toad, and it is found underneath your eyelids, in your armpits, or in your genitalia. It is the equivalent of a birthmark. It sometimes could also be a third breast, a third nipple, and I will talk about that a bit later. These marks, of course, are insensitive to pain. They do not bleed when pierced with a needle. And there is a whole group of people, a rather, should we say, disrespectable group, a rather shady bunch called the prickers, who go around with long needles. When you find someone who is accused of witchcraft and you find that this person has a mark, then you put a needle through the mark, and if it does not bleed and if it does not hurt, that, of course, that's it. That's a sign that you are a witch. And these prickers are the experts in determining whether the mark is truly a mark of the devil or not. Now, you could imagine anyone who is born with a birthmark in some part of your body, and this becomes essentially the target and the emblem of your membership into this covenant of witches. A third breast in 1692, Bridget Bishop, 1692 in Salem, Bridget Bishop was found to have a third nipple. As we know, in nature, there are people who are born with three nipples, and it is not a common occurrence, but it does occur. The third nipple was supposed to be a nipple which was given to you by the devil, not only as a mark of the devil, but as a way in which you can actually suckle your incubus. You can essentially feed your incubus with your third breast. In the case of Bridget Bishop, there are witnesses who testify that they saw a third breast, but 4 or 5 hours afterwards, it had disappeared. Another sign, of course, that the devil was essentially acting through this woman. Now, all these things sound so utterly ridiculous that how we are going to believe them. But the fact, of course, is that people did believe these things and testified to them and, in fact, acted like that. The prickers, essentially, are always appear in a kind of, as a disruptible bunch, not to be trusted and so on. And we're going to see a case, the case of Urban Grandier, later on in another lecture, in which when he is found the mark, and the mark is essentially punctured by a pricker and it does not bleed, that is the ultimate confirmation of the fact that he is a witch, that he is a male witch, he is a warlock. Now, you have signed a pact with the devil, you have now been imprinted with the mark, And I don't have to tell you the unbelievable sexual connotations of being branded with a mark, and how branding and marks play a very important role in early modern society, because slaves begin to be branded in this period as well. So that slaves will have branded in the forehead, saying, "I am the slave of such and such." This is a very common sight in Europe in this period. You will see slaves branded in the forehead to indicate ownership by a specific person, but also the kinds of connotations of branded. The devil brands them, or the devil's representative brands them with an iron. There is an element of pain, there is an element of marking. In a society like ours, in which we are into body piercing and tattooing, we have to recognize the importance, the symbolic importance, the anthropological importance of such branding and such marking. So once you have done that, you have signed the pact, you have been marked by the devil, now you abjure your face. You go through a process, a kind of absolute, a specific process in which you renounce your faith in Christianity. You denounce God. You accept the devil, and in doing so, you also abjure your faith. Then this is followed by the casting away of rosaries and scapularies and all the indications that you essentially are part of Christianity. Now, the rosary did not play a very important role in the Middle Ages, but it's part of the devotions that emerge in the early modern period and become deeply identified with Christian spirituality. Scapularies also are a kind of very late medieval and early modern phenomenon. Scapularies, for those of you who might never heard the term, is a piece of cloth from a monk's habit, which you wear in the back and in the front of you as a kind of symbol that you have taken orders. It's usually dedicated to the Lady of Mount Carmel. And the idea is one of the promises that is, if you wear an scapulary and you wear so in faith, you will never die in mortal sin. You will always have the opportunity of confessing your sins before you die, therefore gaining the kingdom of heaven. Of course, by casting away rosaries and scapularies, you essentially enter into the realm of Satan and abandon that of God. Then you pay homage to the Satan or to his representatives. This is one of the parts in which those writing about witchcraft spend the greatest amount of time, meaning that they will talk about this again and again and again, because it is not a simple act of homage by genuflecting and making sexual gestures, because it involves something that was obscene, but which nonetheless call attention to the relationship of witches to the devil and to the rest of humanity. And we read this in text all the time. It is the kiss. That is to say, and I quote, "The witches kiss the devil in his behind, while the devil emits a foul, fetid, and filthy wind." This still goes on to this very day, I am afraid. But essentially what you have here is the way in which the devil is kissed, the fundament of the devil. I have again another quote from Walter of Langton, a bishop of Coventry, who was accused of doing this. "When the witches paid homage to Satan, Satan offers his back parts to be kissed by his vassals. They kiss," and I add, "the fundament of the devil." And the devil, of course, emits, as I already said, a filthy and foul air. This is a kind of, in a sense, subservient of the witch, of those who practice witchcraft, to the devil. Now, this is followed by a sacrilegious baptism. You are rebaptized. You are entered into the church of Satan. You are giving new good parents, new God parents, and you are giving a new name. Now, this is very important. Now, I am not saying that these things happened. Please understand this. This is a hostile source that argue that this is what happened, but I am not saying that this is what happened. In fact, at the end of this course, or at the end of the section on witchcraft, I will have my own point of view on this whole thing. But everyone in Europe believed that this happened. Now, naming is very important because it gives power. The power of naming is one that is, of course, already present in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis. Man names animals as they parade in front of him. Adam names the animals. So the devil names those who come to him now, give him new godparents, brings him into the fold, as it were. Cotton Mather, writing in New England in the 17th century, wrote that the witches were organized like a congregational church. Of course, that's his point of view and his opinion. Then you cut a piece of your clothing and give it to the devil. A piece of hair. I want you to think of the importance, especially when you were younger, when you lived in a very different world than the one in which you live now, those of you who are listening to this or seeing this, that the exchange of a piece of clothing, of an item that is a personal item, or a piece of your hair, something that is part and parcel of the culture, not only of the Middle Ages, but of the early modern period and of today, in a sense is a magical act in which you give power to someone by giving that person a piece of you, something that is symbolic of you, which the devil will keep and therefore acquire power over you. That in a great deal of magical practices, what we want to do is steal something that belongs to someone else so that we can use it for incantations and so on to provide us with a weapon against this person. One of the favorite tactics in anti-witchcraft practices is essentially to make sure that you leave nothing that belongs to you, your nail parings, feces and so on, that you bury it so that it cannot be used by a witch against you. So by giving a token to the devil, essentially you put yourself in the devil's power. You become one with the devil. And then you enter into the magic circle which is represented in all the movies about witchcraft and so on, the pentagram, the magic circle with the stars, and there you become one part of this community of devil worshippers. And then finally, you promise to the devil to participate or to do some sacrifices. Now, I want to slow down here a bit because, of course, we have to realize that this is essentially a hostile source. This hostile source not only describes how you become a witch, but it also describes the place where witches gather, and it describes the nocturnal gatherings, which are called the Sabbath. And I want to spend the rest of the lecture discussing the Sabbath, discussing the gathering of witches, the nocturnal gathering of witches, and their importance in European society. There are many books written about these nocturnal gatherings. The most recent one is, of course, Carlo Ginzburg's Ecstasies, Deciphering the Witch's Sabbath, which is, again, an attempt to create a kind of archaeology of these practices, going back to very ancient and prehistoric practices, to link them with cult and agrarian cults and all kinds of vegetation beliefs. It was well known in Europe, or at least well accepted in Europe. It was a fact that people truly believe that at certain times of the year, at certain times of the weeks, the witches gather to engage in orgies, to do evil deeds, to worship the devil, and so on. And you could see how this works. You are in a village, and there are the people in the distance carrying candles and jumping in the air. This is where the idea that witches fly comes from. They will have a wand or a piece of hazel wood between the legs. And I want to point out to you the phallic implications of this. The idea that you are jumping with a piece of wood between your legs and that you seem to be floating in the air. And there is a wonderful painting, one of the dark paintings by Goya, which shows this, which shows these people standing or floating in the air. We also know that a good number of people in early modern, late medieval and early modern Europe will have access to belladonna and to other hallucinogenic plants, and that they will in fact cover their bodies with them, and therefore will think to be in a trance, will think to be flying. We still do that to this very day. And therefore it entered into the European mind the idea that witches gather for nocturnal events in which they did all kinds of terrible deeds. Now, it could be as simple as a group of people in the village getting out into the middle of the woods, into a meadows, to do some kind of celebration and having a bit of fun by themselves, and therefore it turns into and is converted into something else. I was preparing this lecture of the movie about the witch trials at Salem, the most recent one with, I think, Winona Ryder, in which the young women go into the woods to practice some kind of, you know, to have fun, and it's turned into a kind of demonic event, some kind of diabolic event in which they are essentially from having fun and talking and dancing and doing the kinds of things that the society represses and does not allow, is turned into a kind of devil worship. They pay with their lives for doing that. Now, the Sabbath, is really not related to the Jewish Sabbath. It's really something taken from Sabbatius, a Phrygian deity, a kind of god of bacchanalia and excess. And they are great and little Sabbaths. They are the little ones which occurred every Thursday, the day before Friday or something like that. And then there are the great days that are associated in the European imagination with great events. The greatest of all gatherings of witches was believed to be Walpurgis Nacht, the 30th of April. Why? Because as we shall see later on when I discuss the importance of May Day, and when we talk about folklore in Europe, Walpurgis Nacht is the eve of May Day. It's a great important day. It's the night of the witches. It is thought that in parts of Germany, thousands upon thousands of witches were carrying the back of devils to these nocturnal gatherings. Walpurgis Nacht is a night of terror. And the practices of Walpurgis Nacht are still, in a sense, remembered, practiced in many parts of Europe today. The building of great bonfires, the burning of the witch on Walpurgis Nacht. Think about that movie, Amarcord, by Fellini, which has a scene in a little town in which they burned the witch on Walpurgis Nacht. The end of winter, the beginning of a spring. May Day is a very important day in European culture. And so the day before is a day for witches. The eve of St. John's Day, the eve of the 23rd of June, it is also another important day, the eve of Christmas. That is to say that all these great gatherings of witches take place precisely on the eve of important Christian celebrations. There is, in fact, a linkage between the liturgy of the church and the agricultural calendar and the celebrations of witches. Then you have, of course, Christmas, and then you have the Little Sabbath. Now, what is done in these gatherings? What happens in this gathering? According to the hostile sources, and I insist and I again reiterate that, according to hostile sources, there are people dressed in animal skins, usually dressed as goats. These are the representatives of the devil. On a platform, on a stage, sit the representative of the devil, or the devil himself, usually in the form of a he-goat, or dressed like a bear. And there he will sit together with the oldest of all the witches, and they will preside over this gathering. And at this gathering, they will have great dinners. They will eat great foods, substantial, beautiful food prepared without salt, because salt is a symbol of eternity, and all the food they will eat without salt. They will drink Malmsey, and what was supposed to be an aphrodisiac, a kind of sweet wine, which they thought was an aphrodisiac. They will engage in orgies, in a kind of promiscuous sexual exchanges, where the devil will select the witches he wants for his own. There, at these nocturnal gatherings, the devil will provide the witches with either an incubus or a succubus. If you are a female, you wear an incubus. If you are a male, you wear a succubus. That is to say, you will get a spirit that will satisfy for you all the things you want sexually, that will accompany you, that will take the place, or that will take the form of a cat, which is why the association between witchcraft and black cats. It will take the form of a little animal, and it will accompany you and suddenly become a human figure and will provide you with all kinds of sexual pleasures. And these people never get tired. They are there for you all the time, which is more than can be said for the majority of humans. So in a sense, you could see that. And then you also engage in dancing, in kind of orgiastic dancings and think of the importance of dances in religious observation. Think of King David dancing in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Think of the importance of dancing. I always think, of course, of dancing in terms of Holy Week in Seville. I think of the gypsies dancing and singing and sending saetas as the virgins, the different virgins of the neighborhood go through the streets of Seville. The kind of association between the sacred and the movement of your body and the sensuality of your body. There is, of course, the use of phallus, artificial phallus. Artificial phallus are quite common throughout Europe in this period. The church edicts again and again condemn the use of artificial phalluses. And they are another charge that is raised against the witches, that they use artificial phalluses in their performances. You sacrifice animals, you collect toads and kill them right there, or bats. And then, of course, the worst of all charges, that you kill children, that you sacrifice children, that midwives among them will steal children, have just born, and you will sacrifice the children and shed the blood and then eat them and make them into pies and then eat them. There you have it. Cannibalism and child murder. Those are the two great and important charges that are raised against witches. Now, I want to stop here for a second, and I want you to think as you listen to this or look at this, that these are precisely the same charges that have been used against Christians at the beginning of Christianity, were used against Jews, were used against lepers, were used against Muslims, and will be used against the natives in the New World. That is to say, extreme prurient and lewd behavior, murder and sacrifice of children, and acts of cannibalism. Those are precisely the charges that separate humans from those who are considered to be against nature, to be utterly human. It is a kind of, should we say, permanence of these charges. This will be the charges that will be raised against gypsies later on. There are always the way in which you link together anti-Semitic charges of child or ritual child murder, cannibalism, and you use them as a way of defining otherness, as a way, as in a sense, of identifying those who are different from you, utterly different, who have gone beyond the boundaries of humanity and who therefore do not deserve to live. I want to point out to you that we as Westerners, that is to say, we who have been made from a very particular and unique kind of cultural experience, at the very roots of our making into civilized people lies always the fact of child sacrifice. And that it is indeed very clear that the very early religions of mankind began with the act of the child sacrifice, of the firstborn, and that the covenant between God and Abraham in the Judaic tradition, and therefore in the Christian tradition and in the Islamic tradition, is really all about that, about the replacement of the child who must be sacrificed to God so he can placate the anger of God, and his replacement by something else, by a different kind of sacrifice. So at the very roots of these accusations, which in fact branded the witches, which were read avidly by people throughout Europe, it's a series of charges that are as old as humanity itself, that go back to the very beginnings of our history and which have been deployed again and again and again for the purpose of, in fact, creating otherness, creating someone who is very different from us, for a way, for the purpose of excluding someone from the community, bringing them to trial and executing them. Thank you.